on digital and online.
This is BBC Radio 5 Live.
bbc.co.uk/5live.
This is Simon Mayo here on 5 Live.
This is Mark Kermode. Movies to review in the next hour. Brooklyn's Finest, Greenberg, Letters to Juliet and Black Death.
You sound down already.
No, Black Death.
Gonna
that
have
was
to
me
do
standing
something
up.
About that. 5 Live. So everything's shifting round because the launch of the World Cup, of course, this afternoon, which was news to Mark, but I explained it to him precisely why we are where we are. The next 3 weeks, we're going to be on Saturday mornings between 11 and 12. You're looking at me completely puzzled, Mark.
No, I'm glad to have that filled in because I did tweet yesterday. Somebody said, you know, what's going on, and I tweeted, I imagine it's sports related, ask Dr M, and it's nice that I have now found out that that is what it is.
Here's a great email from Sam White. In fact, it's the email of the day. We're going to start with this. Sam says, dear hello to and Jason Isaacs, loyal podcaster here, recently graduated and have managed to get a job working in Hollywood.
Hey.
Now, I'm not sure if he's our only podcast listener working in Hollywood, but, you know, we'll find out if there are any more.
If there are, yeah.
Reading through the trade papers earlier today, both Pirates 4 and Transformers 3 have been given summer 2011 release dates. How does Mark feel about this? Will next year finally be the year where, in Cannes, Mark passes out from lack of oxygen as he reviews these two summer blockbusters? Sam, BA honours, hopefully found out a week on Friday. Then he adds this glorious PS.
Go on.
I walk past the production office for Pirates 4 every day on my way to the office. Is there anything that you'd like me to say as I walk past?
Yeah, stop.
Okay, so Sam, he's just got a job, though, so maybe he has to be slightly more creative than that.
No, literally, just walk past and just say, stop.
If you can do better than that, 85058, mayo@bbc.co.uk. Advice for Sam, he works in Hollywood, he walks past the Pirates 4 office every day, he wants to open the door and say something. Bear in mind, he would quite like not to get the sack, okay? So if maybe there's a way of being constructive as well as being to the point. Sam, we'll try and help you out.
Did you know that somebody on Twitter put a thing, a connection to this lovely thing, which is, I think the name was Rain Day or Rainy Day, that Michael Bay admits Transformers 2 was flawed.
I think that's the essence of your review.
Promises that Transformers 3 will be better. And he admits, he says, you know, the characters are all over the place, and he blames it on the fact that because there was a writer's strike, that was why they didn't have a proper script. It's like, Michael, come and review the film here on Radio 5 and tell us all how bad it was.
Diana Whitmill in Staffordshire. Dear S&M, I'm risking what Simon ominously refers to as a long email in dark tones, as I have a couple of queries for the doctors and the corporation. Well, I've just got rid of the first one just to make the email a little bit shorter. An old friend from school days and I were reminiscing about cinema adverts in the old days before they got slick and boring. You remember those terrible local ads where some stock footage of an Air India jet taking off would be followed by the voiceover man intoning happily, "You don't have to go all the way to India for a real Indian meal."
Yes.
And a still of the local tandoori followed. Well, we celebrated a particularly infamous cinema advert for, of all things, a local jeweller, which ended up, "For special service, ask for Brian." This was always greeted with a cheer, and on busy Saturday nights, the line was usually spoken by everyone that was in the cinema. Well, said friend and I wondered if, as this was the High Barnet cinema in the late 70s, the good doctor had actually been one of those to chorus along with us, a little off his East Finchley stamping ground.
No, I used to go to the Odeon High Barnet. It was great.
Did you ever join in the "For special service, ask for Brian"?
I never joined in. I do remember that there was a... I mean, it's all the stock footage stuff, and then at the very end, it's just a short walk from the cinema. I do remember "For special service," but I don't remember "Ask for Brian." But I did the Odeon and High Barnet was my local stamping ground. That's where I saw Wanderers. That's where I saw Omen. In fact, that's where they had a special screening of Damien Omen 2 because Jonathan Scott. I'm going to say Scott Thomas. I'm thinking of Kristen Scott Thomas. Jonathan Scott, who went to our school, was Damien in Damien Omen 2.
Make it sound as though we went to the same school. When you say our school...
And, okay, fine.
I never know.
The school that I went to Elstree, Jonathan Scott, I think it was called Jonathan Scott, he was the Damien in Omen 2. And although it was an X-certificate movie, they had a special screening when he came back.
Tausif Mehrali, dear doctor and doctors, a fellow doctor, I wish to make a humble request, some forewarning, please, for the good doctor's Danny Dyer impression. I listen to the podcast as an accompaniment to my cutthroat razor shave, working through each podcast in instalments. The actual laugh out loud brought about by Dr. K's hilarious rendition of Mr. Dyer cast as Don Corleone very nearly resulted in a near-death experience for me. Fortunately, no blood was shed, for any small, nor any small animals killed.
And very nearly, very nearly resulted in him cutting his face, so no one else would want to go out with him.
Would the good doctor or his most esteemed host please ensure some form of alert in future, so I may brace myself in, if you do this again. Also, this would by no means be the worst way to meet my maker. I fear my family would be unable to deal with my death by podcast on the paperwork. That would never, ever been done before. So just a little warning for Talsif in future.
The thing is that assumes that I ever planned to. In fact, I a while ago, I stopped doing... entirely. And it only happened again recently because of the... because of the review of Pym, and I hadn't, you know, so I would tell you if I was planning it, but it's not like we sit here with a thing, you know, I'll do Gwyneth Paltrow, I'll do Anthony
Hopkins. Is that true what you said to Victoria, that only 24 people went to see Pym and it made £205?
This is the story that's been reported in the press. I mean, it may be too good to be true, but it's it was over the opening weekend that it was 24 people, a total of £205. I mean, what I want to know is, who are the 24 people that went to see Pym?
Well, if you're one of the 24, you can text 85058 and revel in your uniqueness. Which
it must have been pretty empty screen. I mean, I think it went to DVD pretty fast, but that's a remarkably low turnout.
Dear Agent K and Agent J, this is Callum Johnson. On Friday 28th, a few hours after Wittertainment and during All Request Friday on Radio 2, the identities of the two newest Pokemon were revealed worldwide. This may not be interesting to you, but you'll see where I'm going. May I introduce you to Reshiram and Zekrom? I email you this because the first thing I thought when I saw Reshiram was Flappy Arms. And when I think of Flappy Arms, all I think of is Mark Kermode. So next time I email you on a Friday, it will be addressed to Dear Reshiram and Zekrom. So that explains it. It will be beyond everyone else.
Is there a picture of them?
No, there isn't, no. But I'm sure someone will send us the two newest Pokemon. Very, very exciting. Bruce in Edmonton, continuing the tagline contest, here is mine. Anvil, the story of Anvil. It's about Anvil.
Yes, that's right.
Tim in Portland.
Isn't that a brilliant title of Anvil, the story of Anvil?
It kind of is. You can't do a tagline on that. Tim Mitchell in Portland. I took my youngest daughter and two of her friends to see Shrek 4 recently. My reaction was similar to that of finding out that your best mate has been cheating on your sister. You forgive him because he's your best mate despite everything, but you can't help feeling that he's let you down and the relationship is never quite the same again and family dinners will become complicated.
That's a lovely review. I haven't seen Shrek 4 ever after yet, but I'm sure it's going to be... I mean, it's, you know, I think we all thought at the end of Shrek 3 that they had completely... That was it. All the jokes were now done. There weren't any other jokes. There was nothing else to do.
So what do we have coming up then? We'll do a box office top 10 in just a moment and some of your Sex and the City emails as well. Okay. But our new movies are...
Greenberg, Black Death... Brooklyn's Finest, starring Richard Blinky Gear. And in fact, I've chosen you a clip in which you can actually hear Richard blink and exhale.
Well, an exhale, I can imagine. I don't suppose you can ever hear someone blink.
You'd be surprised. Yeah, listen to this clip we've got. If you listen closely, you can hear the blinking power of Richard.
Well, it's approaching 12:15. That's all to come then. Movie reviews in an unusual place because it's the start of the World Cup. We're here till 1 o'clock. Then it's Mark Pugach. Let's update you with the travel. TV's Lindsay goes first.
Thanks very much, Simon. The M54 closed westbound between Junction 6 and 7, Telford and Wellington. That's because of the closure of the A5, because of a lorry fire there, westbound between the M54 and M Street Island. In Edinburgh, the M9 has two lanes closed southbound between Junction 1A, Kirkliston, and 1 at Newbridge. That's because of an oil spillage. There's an overturned caravan on the M18 northbound between Bramley and Junction 2, Junctions 1 and 2 there. That's northbound. Just getting reports of an overturned car on the M42 southbound just before the Redditch Junction at Junction 3. The M62 westbound, there's a multi-vehicle accident between Tingley and Gildersham. That's 28 to 27. The M62 60, there's an accident clockwise blocking two lanes at Barton, that's Junction 11. That's causing tailbacks to Junction 8, Carrington. And there's also an accident northbound on the M6 between Lym Interchange and Woolston, 20 to 21. And on the M1 in the roadworks area, northbound between 12 and 13, that's Flitwick and Bedford, and that's causing queues to Junction 10 at Luton Airport. Lindsay Hipgrave, 5 Live Travel.
The saying goes that a hot cup of tea in summer will cool you down. But there's nothing hotter than a World Cupper. The football equivalent of a boot jalocchia chilli.
South Africa 2010.
Today, the opening day of the tournament kicks off with Nicky Campbell in Johannesburg for 5 Live World Cup Breakfast.
From 1.
Mark Pugach has all the build-up to the first match. Host nation South Africa play Mexico.
Kick-off, 3 o'clock.
Then at 7.30, commentary of Uruguay against France. World Cup football on 5 Live and 5 Live Sports Extra. Every game from every ground.
This is 5 Live, all the films from every screen, and this email from Jay, listening live for once at work, dear Dante and Randall. Would it be... That's right.
Clerks,
it?
Yeah.
Surely the best cinema advert, we're talking about the old-fashioned ones, has to be at the ABC Crawley, when the advert for Hobgoblin Music finished with the line, "So don't forget, when you've finished watching this film, come to Hobgoblin Music for all you want in guitars, drums and hurdy-gurdies." I'm not sure how many people were influenced, but one hopes that Crawley had the highest amount of hurdy-gurdies per head of population in the UK. How about that?
That band Noah and the Whale had a hurdy-gurdy.
Good, thanks for that. So here's our box office top 10 at 10, Four Lions.
Which I like. I mean, as I said, it's not laugh out loud funny, and I don't think it was intended to be. I'm still surprised that those how many funnies it are quoted on the poster, but I do think it's a good film. I think its heart is in the right place. I liked it.
Adam, on this email, in response to a previous emailer accusing those laughing throughout Four Lions of doing so to demonstrate their liberal credentials, perhaps instead they just found it genuinely funny.
Yeah.
Everyone has a different sense of humour. I enjoy black absurdist comedy, chortled heartily throughout both Four Lions and Dr. Strangelove. Not because I found the message any less profound or moving, but simply that, for me, it's funny. I don't necessarily equate laughing at absurdity with lightness or frivolity. I can be moved and chuckle at the same time. Bad Lieutenant is at 9.
You know, as promised, I went back and saw this again, and I'm still unconvinced as to its weightiness. It is, I think, in the end, still an incidental Herzog movie, but I do like it because I like Herzog. And Nick Cage is completely out of control, but in that kind of slightly controlled way. I mean, it's a much more likeable film than the Ferrara Bad Lieutenant, but it doesn't have that raging Catholic guilt, which I was kind of taken with in the first one. I mean, it's a lot more fun to watch, and it's a lot more enjoyable. And I can't imagine putting the Ferrara on again of an evening. You know, oh, I've got some time free. I know, I'll watch Harvey Keitel going into the bowels of hell. But I still think this is fun, but not a whole lot more than that.
The Losers at 8.
Which wasn't anything like as much fun as it ought to have been. I mean, it's, you know, it looked like a sort of Dumbo smash 'em up, but it let me down even on that level.
At 7, Space Chimps 2, Zartog Strikes Back.
Now, this is the one that I haven't seen because I was off. I did see Space Chimps 1, so any reviews of Space Chimps 2, keep them short.
Iron Man 2 at 6.
Which is still hanging on in there, still doing very well, despite the fact that a lot of people complained when it came out that it was a mess, blah, blah, blah. I think it was no more of a mess than the original. You can see that there have been some post-production issues. Mickey Rourke does his Mickey Rourke thing, but it's worth it for the stuff between Robert Downey Jr. and Gwyneth Paltrow, which remains funny.
Tooth Fairy at 5.
Nothing like as funny as I wanted it to be. And here's a question. Is Tooth Fairy in some way sponsored by Fender? It's an interesting thing because there's a whole thing in it that there's the kid in it has got a Fender guitar, and then the Fender guitar gets broken, and then the Tooth Fairy gets him another Fender guitar, and then whilst the Tooth Fairy is playing ice hockey, there are adverts for Fender all around. I know that I'm very slow on picking up on this stuff, but even I started to wonder, am I seeing the name Fender being bandied around here?
Now, it's Robin Hood at 4. A couple of emails saying the same kind of thing. Susan in Edinburgh, may I say your show... with Mark, which I hear as a podcast each week, is most entertaining.
Is it?
Love the show, Steve.
Excellent.
I've been listening for a number of years and in general agree with Dr. Kermode in his opinions. However, after seeing Robin Hood last night on the way home from work, I feel moved to point out that he is in fact wrong. I chose to see the movie with some trepidation given the comments on accents, etc. However, it was the one I could get to at the exact right time to chill out after work, so I still went to see the movie anyway. Besides, it has Russell Crowe in it, so how bad could it be? I was entertained, and the rather nice-looking and well-shaped Mr. Crowe even took his top off. The film was not historically correct and did not follow the legend, but who cares? It was a rollicking good show.
That's the problem, is it wasn't a rollicking good show.
It just adds, as a PS, The Exorcist is one of my favourite films. If I recall rightly, it was my first legal 18 movie. We queued up for hours to get in, and as we waited, the Samaritans gave us a flyer with their number on it, just in case we were disturbed.
Yeah.
How great was the hyping up of the expectations as a result of that? Anna Patai from Budapest. Thus far, I've stayed away from Robin Hood due to the good doctor's recommendation, but when I finally saw it, I found it was a lot better than I expected. Although I think it would be better if actors were allowed to use their own voice. Crow's accent was nowhere near as bad as Simon Pegg in Star Trek or Ewan McGregor in Angels and Demons.
No, but, Simon Pegg wasn't arguing that Star Trek was historically accurate and to be taken very seriously. He didn't go and ask Billy Bragg to act as a political advisor on it. It was Star Trek.
As English isn't my first language, I have no idea what a Nottingham accent sounds like, but surely those demanding authenticity should only be satisfied with a Passion of the Christ level of commitment, as Richard I spoke very little English, and 11th century English must be closer to the language of Chaucer than any modern regional dialect. Yes, it was too long, full of inconsistencies, and the entire film was the dirty brown colour of a used tea bag, yes. But I found it no more implausible and no less entertaining than Gladiator at the time.
Okay.
So Prince of Persia is at number three.
Which is... It's not as bad as Pirates of the Caribbean.
It's good fun.
Yeah, well,
it's better than that. It's more fun than I think you have let on.
No. I quite enjoyed bits of it. I mean, it's, you know, funny, the screen I was at, Jerry Bruckheimer came on at the beginning and introduced it. And there is that whole thing about the sight of Jake Gyllenhaal running around with his shirt off. And you think, oh, you know, wow, he's really kind of been working out. Ben Kingsley doing the performance that he does in Thunderbirds, basically, as the character who we're not meant to realise from the very beginning is perhaps not all good. But it's
he plays the role that Jeremy Irons takes in Lion King.
Yes.
Bad uncle.
Yes.
And you know straight away bad uncle is after the throne.
Exactly. But it's okay. It's no better than okay. Gyllenhaal was an interesting bit of casting, but it is shorter and funnier and better than Pirates of the Caribbean.
Stephen Harvey in Wellington. I went to see Prince of Persia at the weekend with the family. Good, workmanlike, dumb fun. It also occasioned the revelation of a universal truth when Ben Kingsley first appeared on the screen as the King's brother. My son, aged 12,
booed,
leant over to his brother, aged 10, and whispered, "Never trust a bald guy wearing mascara." Now, that, you have to say, is pretty good wisdom. You know, if there's anything else that you... I mean, you could take that through life, and in general, that's going to be right.
I thought you were going to say he leaned over and went, "That's Sir Ben Kingsley to you."
No, not quite. Street Dance 3D is at 2.
Which I liked. I enjoyed it. It was good fun. I mean, it didn't need to be in 3D, but of all the films that I've seen in 3D, it's the one in which the 3D bothered me the least. And, boy, they can leap around, and it's good fun.
Let's just do a few. One or two.
Come on.
Emails about Sex and the City 2, which is the UK's number one. First of all, Michael...
shame upon all of you.
Michael from Carrickfergus.
Well, did you hear the good news? They're not making Sex and the City 3 because... poor box office and lousy reviews have put them off the idea. Yes, there is a purpose to all this.
It's still number one. Michael from Carrickfergus. It was with some shock and a little embarrassment that the other night, whilst making up the 5% quota of sheepish-looking heterosexual men in Sex and the City 2, I had the following realisation. I don't hate this. After the Good Doctor's quote-unquote non-rant, a wealth of other negative reviews and the atrocious first film, I was prepared for 2.5 hours of non-stop transvestite standard girl talk, reductive female stereotypes and a fashion label assault on the senses. What I got was a good 45 minutes to an hour.
It's all about plus racism.
Like a subpar episode of the series. Yes, the main character, Carrie's neurotic tendencies were played to such an extreme that all sympathy for her was lost. Yes, the Abu Dhabi stuff is likely to result in a fatwa against the four fashionistas. And yes, Liza Minnelli's performance was truly terrifying. But I didn't feel as though I'd been hit over the head with a Gucci handbag. The presentation of women in the film was garish and crude, but not totally divorced from reality. Women are just as likely to be vapid and self-obsessed as men are to be violent and chauvinist. Cleansed of Warrington. Sex and the City 2, as we all know, is an acronym. SATC2 is an acronym for Sex and the City 2. Having just had the misfortune to waste an Orange Wednesday deal on it, my friend and Sharon have decided that it actually stands for Shameless Atrophied Totalitarian Codswallop 2. Jane. Having just been coerced into watching Sex and the City 2, I am really sad to say how much this film affected me. I feel absolutely disgusted to be a woman after spending 2.5 hours watching such selfish, spoilt and sickeningly shallow examples of women being held up as aspirational figures. It was soul-destroying, and there's a lot more where that comes from. Emma Marr. I know Mark hates it and can't understand why women flock to watch it, but ask Mark this. Mm-hmm. How many movies in the top 10 this week are movies that focus almost exclusively on female leads, not including children's movies. That's right, it's one. How many movies in the top 10 this entire year focus almost exclusively on female leads? At best, if you include It's Complicated, I get a grand total of two. Sometimes women just want to watch women on screen talking about their lives, sex, husband, clothes, children and work. It's so rare that when it happens, we manage to overlook the frivolous and offensive elements that get Mark in a lather and just enjoy the novelty of seeing a movie that doesn't feature or where the plot is not driven primarily by men.
Good point, well made.
Is that it?
Well, it's true. I mean, that is absolutely true. I mean, when I was reviewing it, I was trying to focus not on the gender thing, but on the class thing, and I was actually just humming the second verse of Red Flag just then. But no, it's perfectly true. I mean, the worst of this is that during the golden age of Hollywood, you had what are now referred to as women's pictures, but actually were basically melodramas. They were the birth of screen melodramas as we know them, and they were the most successful, the most popular, the most artistically interesting, the most rewarding of all genres. And what has happened? It's been replaced by cinema for 14-year-old boys. I agree. It's a terrible state of affairs. And when you're in that position, and when SATC2 is the only thing, it's the only drop of water in an otherwise horrendous drought, that's a grim situation. But it's a perfectly legitimate point, and I understand it entirely.
Right, so given that we only have 1 hour rather than two, let's leave it there and get a new movie release in before the news, and then we'll ease on through to 1 o'clock.
Yeah, so Greenberg, which is the new movie by Noah Baumbach. Now, you remember when when Noah and the Whale came on the show, and Charlie Fink was here because they'd made a film
with his hurdy-gurdy.
They didn't have the hurdy-gurdy with them at that point. Maybe it was a Mellotron that they had, not a hurdy-gurdy. I'm not entirely sure. Anyway, and I said, well, you clearly named yourself after Noah Baumbach's film, The Squid and the Whale. And he said, yes. And I said, shame, such a rotten film. I've never been a huge fan of Noah Baumbach because he's one of those people that basically makes movies about uptight, intellectual, dysfunctional rich people complaining about their lives and moaning and whinging and having a bad time and doing it in a kind of intellectual way. Well, so no big change here. The story here with Greenberg is it's Ben Stiller. Ben Stiller is the disaffected, dysfunctional, disillusioned, blah blah blah, insert all those adjectives, who's just recovering from a nervous breakdown, who goes to stay in his brother's house in LA, where he is set upon doing nothing other than, it turns out, being actually oddly unpleasant to the house help. Here's a clip.
I'm impressed by you.
In what way?
I don't know. I mean, you seem really fine doing nothing. It's like you don't feel all the pressure to be successful. I mean, by other people's standards.
I almost had a record deal when I got out of college. I haven't done nothing.
Cool.
I want to be doing nothing. I'm doing nothing deliberately.
That's what I'm saying. I don't know that I could do nothing and be that cool with everything.
Do you want to spend time with those people? See, here's the problem. There's something vaguely admirable about managing to create characters who are so unlikable and so self-centered and so narcissistic as the Roger Greenberg character played by Ben Stiller. I mean, I believed in the character enough to really not care. That's the point. I mean, I genuinely believe that the character he was playing was all those things, and I genuinely believe that I didn't care about him. Essentially, what happens is he noodles and poodles and messes around and writes complaining letters to people, and then sort of falls into an affair with Florence, played by Greta Gerwig, who is really, really good, really has a real kind of... You totally believe her character. She seems genuinely authentic, and there's nothing mannered about her performance whatsoever. And the fact that you like her so much means the fact that the Greenberg character is so rotten to her is really annoying. And the fact that she actually likes the Greenberg character is even more annoying. And I just sit there in this increasing state of irritation, which is, I don't care what happens to this guy. And in order for the film to work, I have to have some emotional investment in him. And Reese Ifans comes along playing his best friend. Actually, Reese Ifans has the best part in the film, in that he was the friend of Greenberg's before he was let down by the fact that Greenberg, they were on the brink of a record contract. It never happened because Greenberg pulled away from it. It didn't happen. And Reese Ifans' character says a lovely thing towards the very end of the film. He says, why don't you ever ask me about how my kid's doing? It's all to do with you. That's exactly it. And it's an authentic portrayal of somebody about whom it is all to do with them. But I just don't understand why you'd want to spend time in his company. And I suspect Noah Baumbach actually likes the Greenberg character much more than the film would perhaps suggest. And in the end, we are supposed to be charmed by his quirkiness and charmed by his noodling around and charmed by his strange awkwardness and charmed by the fact that he's really difficult. And I'm just thinking, I'm not charmed by any of this. You're a difficult, self-centred, snot-nosed, intellectual, overprivileged nitwit. Get a job!
It was the way you were looking at me specifically.
No, you know I don't think that about you.
No, it was just disconcerting.
I don't think you're intellectual.
I mean, you flicked your eyes occasionally to tell me.
You see how I did that?
Just to undermine it a little bit. We got an email earlier from Sam White, who works in Hollywood. He walks past the production offices for Pirates 4 every day. Is there anything, he asked, you'd like me to say as I walk past? Mark suggested, stop. Nathan in Northamptonshire says, your man in Hollywood should announce, are you not yet satisfied? To the awful posse preparing to inflict yet another dreadful 7C6 stirrer. Anyway, so that's as good. But I can't think there's anything he can shout which isn't going to lose him his job, and he's only just got there. So I think it has to be slightly more positive, slightly more affirmative.
What about Cutthroat Island?
With an edge. Cutthroat Island. Would that be? How would that help?
Well, because Cutthroat Island was a disastrously poorly performing.
No, that's going to get in the sack. So we don't, Sam, ignore all this. I don't think there's anything constructive you can do. So some new reviews, please, Mark.
Should we do Letters to Juliet? Okay, so Letters to Juliet, which is now, because the World Cup is starting today, which I hadn't actually clocked, now the opening of Letters to Juliet makes sense, because there's been much discussion about this, that during the World Cup, the way that you program films in cinemas is counter-programming, that essentially what you do is, rather than putting in football-themed films, you assume that anyone that's interested in the World Cup is watching the World Cup. Therefore, anyone who's not watching the World Cup will be somebody who wants to do something completely different. So consequently, and this apparently explains the Sex and the City opening, although I'm not entirely sure that that's the case. But so what you'll see now, how long's the World Cup gone for?
It's a month.
A month. So during the course of the next month, you will apparently see a number of movies that are counter-programmed. So Letters to Juliet, which is basically aimed, you know, at there was a question about how many films have got female leads in them. Well, here's one. So Amanda Seyfried. Amanda Seyfried is going on a pre-wedding honeymoon. Therefore, you know it's not going to work out well.
That's called a holiday, then.
No, there's a big discussion at the beginning about why it's not a holiday, because after they've got married, after she's married Gael Garcia Bernal, he's going to be terribly busy. The signs are not good for this. He's going to be terribly busy, so they're going to have a pre-wedding honeymoon. They go off to Italy, go to Tuscany, they wander around, they end up at the wall at which Juliet is meant to have delivered the Romeo, Romeo balcony speech. And she discovers this society, called the Society of Juliet, who lovelorn women come along and take their letters, and they stick them on the wall, and then the society take them off and write replies to them. So, dear Juliet...
Like writing to Santa.
It is, except that you actually get a reply as opposed to just getting presents, okay?
Okay.
So she actually does that. And anyway, so she finds in the wall an old letter which has been there for 50 years, and she says, I want to reply to this. She replies to it, and the letter said, oh, there was a guy, I loved him, but I never met him, and I don't know what's going to happen. 50 years later, Vanessa Redgrave receives the letter that Amanda Seyfried has just written, and immediately turns up in Italy in search of the lost love, what Juliet has encouraged her to do. But she comes with her posh English grandson. Incidentally, the posh English grandson is played by an Australian, which may explain the Robin Hood-esque accent. Here's a clip.
Wait.
Oh, forget. Sorry. She comes.
May I come with you to find Lorenzo?
Come with us. What about this fiancé of yours? You're in the City of Love and you want to come with us?
Yes, I do, because he's busy and I'm free. And, I mean, of course, if it's not an intrusion.
No, it's not an intrusion.
Listen, I do have one thing to tell you first. This is not entirely selfless. It started out as a simple reply to your letter, and now I think it's so amazing what you're doing. And I'd love to write about it.
A journalist?
That's okay.
Grant, a journalist, trying to pry into our private lives, Grant.
Charlie, come on, it's hardly state secrets, is it?
I'm not a journalist. I would like to be someday, but...
And you think Grand Story is your ticket?
I think it's a story worth telling.
I'd love to have you with us.
Now, simple question. Are there not enough way-faced, public school-looking, foppy-haired, toffee, English, young, hunky actors around to have cast one of them, rather than to have got somebody from the other side of the world and said, can you do posh English? To which the answer, incidentally, is no. I mean, surely there's an entire generation of sub-Hugh Grants on the rise, aren't there?
Yeah, but so all Americans have all American films just have to have Americans in.
No, but if you're going to cast somebody else, right? They have to have something. If they, I mean, they have to be able to do the accent, because the whole point about this character is he's now. Can you guess what's going to happen? She goes on a pre-honeymoon with this other guy, who's then too busy to do anything with her. She then teams up with Vanessa Redgrave and the hunky toffee, you know, English guy who's actually Antipodean, and they have to spend time together looking for Vanessa Redgrave's ex-love. Who, you know, from 50 years ago. Do you think there's any chance that during the course of the drama there will be a reconciliation? That what will happen is that the toffee-nosed English bloke will somehow warm towards Amanda Seyfried's American judge. Do you think there's any possibility of that?
It sounds quite likely. I think that's the way you're teeing it up.
Okay.
I do have to say, there are quite a few Wei Fei English actors like Robert Arpatz.
Robert Arpatz, yes.
Right. Well, he can pass himself off as an American, can't he?
Yeah, but what I'm saying is that in this particular case, your man here can't pass himself off as a Brit. It does sound like Dick Van Dyke, but posh, which is a problem. But that problem aside, the problem that obviously it exists in a world in which it's possible to post a letter from Italy, it arrives in England 12 hours later, and probably the next day, somebody having received it is able to be in Italy. The fact that it has the most unbelievably contrived plot twist, and it is just sappy and silly and drippy and all that sort of stuff. You know what? I kind of liked it. And one of the things I liked about it was this. It kind of liked itself, and the characters were kind of likeable. And I saw it the same day that I saw Greenberg, in which it's these... Oh, I gotta do nothing. I gotta do nothing. Oh, I like doing nothing. Oh, it's so great the way you do nothing. In Letters to Juliet, right?
What voice was that?
It's just the all-purpose, you know, self-regarding, academic, whinging, you know,
all that in one frog sounding sound effect,
as opposed to Letters to Juliet, which is basically a kind of breezy, you know, silly fantasy rom-com. I mean, it's not up there with Princess Diaries, but frankly, what is? But it's lifted shoulder high by, well, Amanda Seyfried, I think, is very likable anyway. But Vanessa Redgrave is an extraordinary screen presence. I mean, obviously, I love The Devil's the Ken Russell movie, which I think is, you know, shrieking.
You must tell us about that.
Yes, I must do. But in this particular case, how nice to see a film that essentially the central plot, rather than what's happening with the young people, the central plot is that Vanessa Redgrave is looking for the love that she lost 50 years ago. And you know what? Because it's Vanessa Redgrave, you care about it. Also, she's extraordinary the way she commands the camera, but she does appear to be performing in a movie which has sort of strange, you know, biographical overtones. I mean, obviously, I don't want to give away the ending, but you can see from the poster, incidentally, that there is a role for Franco Nero. And there is something about the way in which Vanessa Redgrave can take even the flimsiest script, something which is essentially just cotton wool, and yet deliver it in a way that you suddenly find yourself thinking, I'm kind of going with this. And I mean, as I said, I think it's aimed primarily at 12 to 14 year old girls, and it's kind of sweet and charming and goofy, along with being sick. I mean, I sat there in a screening room full of critics who were feeling quite snidey and sneery about it because it's so ridiculous, because it's, you know, it is gooey and treacly and all those other things. But every minute that Vanessa Redgrave was on screen, you know, I was totally with it, even when she was on screen with the guy who can't do the English accent. And Amanda Seyfried, I said, I think is a good screen actress. I mean, people remember from Mamma Mia, and she's kind of playing to that here. Also, you get the feeling they all probably had a nice holiday. It's one of those movies that reminded me of, before the 1970s, movies used to all the time have a scene in an airport, and then they go, because people didn't travel that much. And the idea, you go to the movies in order for like a travelogue thing. I was going to see the new James Bond film. Where does it take place? Switzerland. I've never seen Switzerland. And there was a sense of that. It was like, oh, look at this. Look at the lovely countryside. Look at the lovely sunshine. Look at the lovely wine. You can almost smell the flowers, can't you? And in the case of Vanessa Redgrave's performance, I could. I liked it.
So let's remind you, the movies which you still have to do for one...
Black Death.
Oh, Black Death, which I can tell you have a sense of enthusiasm about.
Black Death.
Just by the way you're announcing it, it sounds as though it's going to be worth waiting for.
And then Brooklyn's Finest.
Okay, all to come before 1 o'clock. A couple of emails picking up on The Killer Inside Me. A couple of weeks ago, we spoke to Michael Winterbottom on this programme. And
cited you in this on this subject in a piece that I just wrote for The Observer. Just a little thing. But I did say I had used the phrase, my good friend and colleague Simon Mayo, brackets, whose opinion I trust.
Well, that was a lie, wasn't it?
Oh, no, whose opinion I respect. And everyone tweeted saying, that's like saying with great respect, or if, you know...
Anyway, Nick Proctor says, why did Michael Winterbottom make this film? Was film noir next on his list of things to do? I think that may be true, actually, yes. I think having identified a genre he would like to work in, then considered what he, as an artist, could bring to it to make it a Michael Winterbottom film or un film noir de Michael Winterbottom. That's fair enough. And in deciding to show the violence towards the women in the way that he has, then I guess he's been successful. It's certainly his film to which he will be forever linked, like a dog is forever linked to the unfortunate steaming mess it's made in the middle of a living room carpet. Jim Thompson in the book used a metaphor, or possibly a simile, not sure, about hitting a pumpkin when he describes the beating. Winterbottom shows us what Jim Thompson meant, thus subtracting from the material rather than adding to it. Whenever an artist says they're going to show the audience something awful because the audience needs to be told, what they really mean is that they're going to show themselves showing the audience something awful because they need to show off, says Nick Proctor. And an email from Richard in Cambridge is quite a long one, but it concludes, my question is this, can a film about such subject material, however correctly depicted, avoid glamorising it? I'm not convinced that this film does enough to steer the viewer to the correct conclusion.
I mean, yeah, I think it's a complicated issue. I don't feel exactly the same as you do, although I do understand why people have responded as they have to it. I don't think that Michael Winterbottom genuinely understands the effect that the film has had on some people. I mean, my conclusion in the end is that I'm agnostic on the subject of Winterbottom's intentions. I don't know exactly what he intended to do. I do think the fact that the film has provoked such intelligent discussion about the nature of violence on screen, and particularly the role of women in screen violence, is overall a good thing.
But when we asked him in the course of the interview, essentially whether he had any idea of the fuss he was going to get involved with, I don't think he gets it.
No, really. I agree with that. I think he doesn't understand it. And but Boyd Hilton, I think, made a good point saying you can't have it both ways. You either did it intentionally to be horrible and therefore expected the audience to recoil, or you were surprised when the audience recoiled. You can't have it both ways. And I think that's a valid point. I have to say, I think as a Thompsonian adaptation, I think it's very impressive. Its use of music is really fine. And there are other things in the film. It's a shame in a way that the whole discussion has become about violence, but on the other hand, there is much more intelligent discussion of violence as a result of this film than we've heard a lot of times this kind of thing comes up. So I think its net effect has been good.
Andy in Birmingham, as we move on seamlessly to Black Death.
Yes.
Dear Mark and Lard, is Black Death the first film in years where Sean Bean isn't killed off in the first 10 minutes? Regards, Andy.
Yes, I know. It's a weird thing, isn't it? Sean Bean and the... shall we hear a bit of Sean Bean? I've got a clip which has got Sean Bean in it. Also, the magnificent David Warner story is Black Death, 14th century England. There is some Black Death around. There are some people living in a...
It's death.
It's death. It's black. And... They're the religious community. They're in a monastery, and they have heard tell that out there in the world there is. Oh, don't hear it from me. Let Sean Bean explain it, and listen out for David Warner. And David Warner turns up at the beginning and the end. You could always have more David Warner, but here's just a snitchit.
I am Ulrich, envoy to the bishop. What I say now does not leave these walls. Word has reached the bishop of a village that does not suffer as the rest do. They say it is a sanctuary from the pestilence.
There are many villages that have not been ravaged yet by the pestilence.
It is claimed these villages are beyond death's icy grasp.
And they are gravely mistaken.
These are difficult times. Such claims, however fantastical, can find favour with those less educated than you or I.
Precisely why we cannot fall foul of rumour and superstition.
God's grip on his people is loosened. We must ensure the flock is not tempted to look beyond God and church for answers. I must see for myself how this village is kept safe.
Now, you introduced that by saying it was a snitchit.
A snitchit.
Is a snitchit longer than a snippet?
It's shorter than a smidgen.
Is it a soupçon?
No, a soupçon is, I would say, more than that. A smidgen is shorter than a soupçon, and a snitchit is shorter than a smidgen.
And a snippet?
That's longer than a yeah, yeah.
Anyway, it was good because your David Warner there sounded like Tony Benn.
He did. He's fantastic, wasn't he? The character he plays in Man with Two Brains is Dr. Necesta, isn't it? Of course, and you know he's in several other very very important movies. And he's in a key role in Straw Dogs. He's the guy who famously loses his head in the original version of The Omen, which is something they struggled to reproduce in the remake. Anyway, I love David Warner. So the story is they go off in search of yon village which has not been struck down by the pestilence, and rumour is that the reason it hasn't been struck down by the pestilence is because they are doing ungodly things there. And then they get to the village, and then I don't want to spoil what happens, but essentially what you need to know is this. It's directed by Christopher Smith, who did Triangle, who came on the show. I was off that week, but he came on the show the week of Fright Fest, and I really like Triangle. It's a really good sort of ghostly thriller set on an ocean liner in which it's, you know, stripped down, very very tight environment, small cast of characters, twisty idea, worked very well, like him very much. And he's made films with Danny Dyer in the past. Here you have a terrifically pestilential air. I mean, that's what you need. For a film called Black Death, you want to feel the pestilence. And, you know, and there is a lot of pestilence. There are some early scenes which actually reminded me to mention it for the second time this hour, of Ken Russell's The Devils, the beginning of The Devils, you know, the 17th century France overrun by plague, and there is that sense of a country completely overrun by some horrible corrupt infestation. Well, you do get that. Then they go off on their quest, and as they go off on their quest, you realise that essentially what you're watching is the Wicker Man gets the plague with some witchfinder general, and with hints of Aguirre Wrath of God thrown in for good measure, and an awful lot of mud and pestilence. And Tim McInerney, yes. Who is great, and he was good to the point that he came on screen and I didn't recognise him as Tim McInerney, and then I suddenly went, oh, that's Lord Percy, which I must be incredibly annoying because he's actually a broad actor, but he's a good enough actor to have thrown that off. And so I enjoyed it. I like the idea that it's got a sort of twisted theological bent. It's the idea of, you know, warring theologies, warring religions like that. I mean, it's obviously made on a fairly limited budget, but what it does with that budget, in the same way as I think it was going to be released earlier, but it was put back because Centurion was out, and because Valhalla Rising was out, and there was a couple of movies about people trudging across, you know, pestilential lands that they didn't want it to compete with. This, of all of them, I think it's
better than Centurion, is it?
It is, yeah. You didn't like Centurion?
No, I quite enjoyed it, yeah.
I mean, it's much more thoughtful than Centurion. I mean, there's a certain amount of, you know, graphic horror and torture, obviously, but it's a much more... I mean, it is... They said the key text here is Wicker Man. It's to do with going off into a remote community which you don't really understand, and then discovering that actually they kind of really understand you, but you don't really understand them. And it's about warring theology.
So in a few years' time, will Nick Cage star in a remake?
I imagine he will. It'll be made in Utah, and at the end, he'll get out of the Wicker Man because there's a ladder going up the back. But it was good fun. I like Christopher Smith, and it did have a genuinely pestilential air, which I liked.
What else is new?
The new Antoine Fuqua movie, Brooklyn's Finest.
And Antoine Fuqua. What should I remember about Antoine Fuqua?
He directed Training Day, for which Denzel Washington won the Oscar for Best Actor, which was an interesting case because it was like one of those things. People always remember that Denzel Washington won the Oscar, but they're never quite certain which film he won it for. That's the film that he won it for. The story here is a series, this is now very popular, an interweaving series of narratives all set around policemen and cops, of course, being American. And you know that at some point these narratives will come together, and there's a kind of inevitable tragic arc to it. And the whole thing is racked with a sense of male bonding angst and religious guilt. And just one of the themes, I mean, there are several others, but just one of them is Richard Gere, who is approaching retirement, 7 days away from retirement. He's basically completely flawed. He seems to have failed in any crime-fighting ability, and he is now told that he's going to have to take a partner out with him for 7 days. And it's Richard Gere returning to form. Here's a clip.
Here's the deal. Our commissioner, he believes in this new program that puts rookie cops in the highest crime areas. So they want seasoned hairbags like you breaking these recruits in. And since you're the oldest here...
If it's all the same to you, I got 7 days. I'm no one's teacher. I'm not a role model.
God knows you're not, Eddie. But your name came up in a computer, pal. This thing's been kicked up by 2 months, and all eyes are on it. Just do the best you can, okay? Come on, Dugan. Don't you want to do something useful with your last 2 minutes on the job?
No, really.
Did you hear the blinking?
No, because...
No, you did! There's a bit when he goes...
That's called a sigh.
No, blink. But you can hear him closing his eyes. I mean, you can't actually hear it.
Right, my point.
No, if It's that phrase, the man hears no music. You can hear if you have ears.
If you've seen the film
and
you know that
he blinks
there.
No, it's not to do with seeing the film. It's when you know that what Richard Gere does under those circumstances is he goes...
Not what he does normally.
You can see
he
him.
Drops
he drops
his
head.
That's what he does.
He drops
for
his
no reason.
Head.
Does he do that?
No, he doesn't do
last
that anymore.
Last 2 minutes in the service, no. Drop your pants.
No, he doesn't do that anymore because he's now of an age in which dropping the pants is no longer... No, I'm sure he's still... pert, but you know that's not what he does anymore. But what he does in any of those circumstances,
still do it for you.
He literally, I love Richard Gere, he literally almost acts this entire scene with his eyes closed. He blinks so hard that they don't open again. And actually, I thought he was back and forth. It reminded me to some extent of the good work that he did in things like Internal Affairs, the Mike Figgis film. And you know, you look back on Richard Gere's career, and when he's good, he's really good. The thing with Antoine, and I know when he's bad, he makes terrible films, but I still hold that his remake of Abu Dussouf, Breathless, is better than the original. It's certainly got a better soundtrack, and it's better dressed, and he wears better trousers. The thing with Antoine Fuqua is he has this, you know, thing about guys together, and it's an old policier movie in the style of those 70s movies, I suppose. You know, to some extent, it's looking back toward the tradition of French Connection in the same way that the Ridley Scott movie was, the American Gangster was looking back toward that, although it's not in that level. There are solid performances. I like Don Cheadle very much playing an undercover cop who's, you know, completely at the end of his tether and desperate to get out, and is inevitably put into a situation in which he has to snitch on somebody who saved his life but is on the wrong side of the law. And you can see how all these threads are coming together, and as they come together, it becomes more and more contrived and more like, how can we make this bit go and how can we make that path cross with that path? And there's an awful lot of you know, scenes of Ethan Hawke going into a confessional and doing fada, you know, I got a fada thing, you know, and I see I'm a sucker for that. There's like a whole 5 minute sequence in which he's on the other side of the and he's just, oh, you know, I've done so many bad things, I do it. And
is he Irish?
No, he's,
I've done so many,
he's
bad
from
things.
He's from Nottingham. But it's not a masterpiece, but I enjoyed it, and it was lovely to see Richard Gere back on form. And I do think that what Fuqua has is he has a sense of, you know,
is he really called Fuqua?
Well, Antoine Fuqua, F-U-Q. I'm not going to mess around with it, okay?
Because the World Cup is less than a minute away.
Okay, so I enjoyed it. And Richard was back on form.
Chris in Chorley, I went to see this film on Wednesday night, mainly because there was nothing else on, and I'd enjoyed Training Day. Richard Gere did a good Richard Gere-ish job.
He did.
But at one crucial moment, towards the end of the film, I laughed, mainly because the plot line had got so ridiculous.
Yeah, it really does.
This is not good in a thriller.
It does. But in the end, it's not about the plot or the thrills. It's about the fodder. I got it.
Remember today's wisdom from Stephen Harvey, from his 12-year-old leaning to his 10-year-old. Never trust a bald guy wearing mascara. It's very wise from Prince of Persia. And our movie of the week.
Black Death.
It has to be Black Death. Mark, thank you very much indeed.
Thanks for taking the time to download this BBC Radio 5 Live podcast. To find other programmes you might be interested in, click bbc.co.uk/5live, where you'll also find our terms of use.
Hello, me again. To watch my latest reviews, head to www.bbc.co.uk/markkermode and check out my blog, Kermode Uncut.